I don't think it's possible to not know who Emily Carr is if you've lived on the West Coast for any length of time. But let's say that you haven't. What do you need to know? I would say that Emily Carr is the most famous Canadian woman artist, certainly of the last century. She worked primarily in British Columbia, painting the wild forests and the beaches and the coves up the West Coast. She captured the villages and the totems of the native people of British Columbia that she could find by canoe. And she's known as much for her paintings as her writings, as for her eccentric personality. Emily was the youngest of five daughters who were brought up in Victoria, BC, at the tail end of the 1900s. Her father owned a grocery and hardware store, and Emily, it is said, was his favorite. She took art lessons from the age of about eight, and then dropped out of high school shortly after her mother and father died. This was about the time when she turned 19. And to get out from under the harsh, conservative household run by her elder sister, she took off to San Francisco to study art. And from there, she alternated teaching art in British Columbia with going to England and France and studying there under teachers and being influenced by the art community and the movements there. Returning to Vancouver for a while, she was a popular art teacher, but she wasn't interested in teaching children how to paint pretty pictures of flowers and pretty sunsets. So pretty soon, her students all dried up, and she went back to Victoria.
Nobody bought my pictures. I had no pupils, therefore I couldn't afford to keep my studio. I decided to give it up and go back to Victoria. Oh, my sisters disliked my new work intensely. One was noisy in her condemnation, and one was sulkily silent. One was indifferent to every kind of art. The noisy sister said, "It's crazy to persist in this way. No pupils, no sales, you'll starve. Go back to the old way of painting." I'd rather starve. Could not paint in the old way. It's dead, meaningless, empty. Art was taboo in the family, and my kind was considered a family disgrace.
All the words spoken by our Emily this morning are actually written by Emily Carr and taken from her books, Growing Pains, Kleewick, Hundreds and Thousands, and the Journals. Emily, or Millie as her family knew her, was fiercely independent and seemingly unfazed by the criticism and judgments that surrounded her, both of her art and her personal life. And Emily did very little to placate them. In fact, I would say she pushed those judgments and criticisms even higher. Looking out the window of his Simcoe Street home in Victoria, Ira Dilworth, who would later become one of Emily's mentors, watched an odd woman walk down the street. He writes in the foreword to the book Kleewick, quote, "She was a familiar figure in those days. With methodical punctuality, she passed by each morning on her way to the butcher's or the grocer's. She trundled in front of her an old-fashioned baby carriage in which her favorite pet, Woo, sat. A small Japanese monkey dressed in a bright costume of black and red and brown that Emily had actually made. Bounded around her were 6 or 8 of the great shaggy sheepdogs which she raised for sale. And then half an hour later, you'd see her returning, the carriage piled high with parcels. I thought of her then as an eccentric middle-aged lady who kept an apartment house on Simcoe Street near Beacon Hill.
I know I'm not a real downright good landlady, willing to grovel before my tenants and to lick the dirt and grab the checks. It crushes the life out of me, this weight of horrid things waiting to be done because my back hurts and I can't do them myself and I have no money to pay someone else to do them.
She was charming to those that she liked and rude to those that she didn't like, which was most people. When unwanted visitors arrived at her studio, she turned the clocks forward so they would leave earlier. And you've probably all heard the stories of how she would tie up her furniture, her chairs and her tables on homemade pulleys up to the ceiling so there was nowhere for anyone to sit and settle. Emily also stayed clear of marriage, further shocking that conservative social Victoria. Emily saw herself as a professional painter at a time and a place when women simply did not have professions, let alone creative professions. But for Emily, there was no question that her undivided attention must be for her art.
And then maybe I go into the beautiful studio and see some sketches about and feel my skin bursting with things I want to say, with things the place has said to me that I want to express and to dive into and live. And then there's that filthy furnace to clean out and wood to chop and sweeping and dusting and scrubbing and gardening just to keep up an acceptable appearance for the damn tenants so as to squeeze out a pittance of rent to exist on. All the time, you know, you're shriveling up.
Emily found her freedom and her soul when she got out of that stifling and repressive city culture and headed up the coast to paint. For months on end, she canoed from island to island, beach to village, painting the First Nations totem poles, longhouses, and people. Kliwik was the Indian name that was given to Emily by the Ucluelet people, and it means laughing one. She wrote a book of stories about her travels and called it Kliwik. She was undoubtedly proud of her name that was given to her. So different it was from the view of her English family and friends.
So artist. So you too, from the deeps of your soul, down among the dark and the silence, let your roots creep forth, graining, gaining strength. Dive them in deep. Take firm hold of the beloved Earth Mother, and then push toward the light. Draw deeply from the good nourishment of the earth, but then rise into the glory of the light and the air and the sunshine.
Emily, like many artists, are motivated by an energy to create. Creative energy, the source of life that moves through all of us and is accessible to all of us. This primal life force, the source that moves through our sexual energy, through our spiritual energy, and through that creative energy. All three, sexual, creative, and spiritual energies, are braided together, interdependent, if you will, three expressions of that same source. It's not surprising to me that Emily had no need of marriage. What she needed was to paint. Painting was that conduit for her creative, sexual, and spiritual flow. connecting her to the source of life itself, the natural world, her true home.
Oh, everything is green. Everything still and waiting. And slowly things begin to move, to slip into place. Groups and masses and lines form themselves together. Colors you had not noticed come out timidly or boldly, in and out, in and out. Your eye passes. Nothing is crowded. There's living space for all. Oh. Air moves through each leaf. Sunlight plays and dances, and nothing is still now. Life is sweeping through the spaces. Everything is alive. The air is alive. The silence is full of sound. The green is full of color. Light and dark chase each other. Here a picture, a complete thought. And there another. And there. And there.
And in 1927, when Emily was 56 years old, she travels to Ontario to meet Lorne Harris and the Group of Seven and to see her art hung in a large exhibition. For the first time, Emily sees her work at the same level of acceptance and honor as the other leading painters of her day. She is fed by that admiration of her fellow artists, and for the first time she feels like she's found her place. She's found her people. But even then, as she admires their work, her mind is thinking of the difference between how and what she paints and their work. After seeing A.Y. Jackson's paintings of his West Coast trip, she feels something missing in his work, and this inspires her.
The next time I paint Indians, I'm going to go off on a tangent tear. Oh, there's something bigger there. There's something bigger than fact. The underlying spirit, all that it stands for, the mood, the vastness, the wildness, the Western breath of go to the devil if you don't like it. The eternal big spaceness of it. Oh, the West. I am of it. And I love it.
The wild, untamable Western shores and forests were hers to conquer with paint and charcoal. I could talk to you of Emily Carr's work from the point of view of art criticism, or from the feminist point of view, or from the lowly outsider artist point of view. But
something has called out of somewhere. Something in me is trying to answer. It's surging through my whole being like a great river rushing on.
But for me, her work is spiritual. It speaks to me of the transcendental, of that something that emanates through every growing thing, of the mystery in the shadows, of light surmounting darkness, of the weak and the abandoned impossibly reaching for the translucent sky.
Let the movement be slow and savor solidity at the base and rise quivering to the treetops and to the sky, always rising to meet it joyously and tremulously. Oh, if spirit does not breathe through, it is lifeless, dead, voiceless. The spirit must be felt so intensely that it has the power to call all others in passing, for it must pass, not stop in the pictures, but be perpetually moving through, carrying on and inducing a thirst for more.
and a desire to rise.
As she got older and frailer, she could paint less and less. And then at the age of 66, she began to have a series of heart attacks that left her incapable of painting. But she still burned with that creative flow, the juices that needed to find some way to move out of her. She took up writing. Her books about her travels in BC, Kliwik, for example, was hugely popular and won the Governor General's Literary Award. And the book of Small, published the following year, cemented her reputation. Ira Dilworth, who had known Emily since she had been a child, in his position now as a producer at the CBC, produced a number of her stories for the radio. So that in her later years, Emily Carr gained the reputation in Canada that she was fully deserving of. She was and remains an extraordinary woman, not just for her talent alone, but what she overcame in order to express it, and with the uniqueness with which she did express it. It is not every artist that sees the light of divinity moving through the world and is called from deep within themselves to capture it in paint or word. But there are many who do, who struggle each day to see the beauty in this world and move it through their beings so that others, like us, may see it and hear it and feel it.
God is in them all. Now I know that's all that matters. The only thing worth striving for is to express God. Every living thing is God made manifest. All real art is the eternal seeking to express God, the one substance out of which all things are made. Search for the reality of each object. That is its real and only beauty. Recognize our relationship with all life. Say to every animate and inanimate thing, brother. Be at one with all things. Finding the divine in all, when one can do all this, maybe then one can paint. In the meantime, one must go steadily on, with open mind, courageously alert, waiting always for a lead, constantly watching, constantly praying, meditating much, and not worrying.
Isn't it amazing and wonderful that Canada's most famous woman painter, who was ostracized, isolated, misunderstood, criticized throughout most of her life, did not let the cruelty, the loneliness, and the poverty defeat her? What was it that fed her, that drove her, that kept her going? What keeps us going when life is hard, when we're in pain, alone, poor, when we feel nobody understands who we are or appreciates our contribution to the world? One might think that Emily was tough, and maybe she became so, but she also had two emotional breakdowns, and that didn't stop her. Perhaps we could say that she protected herself with a wall of anger, and there may be some fair truth in that. But she also kept her heart open, surrounding herself with her beloved pets, her native friend, Sophie, and the many trips that she took to go deep into the forests. I think what can give us strength to keep going when our lives are hard, and what kept Emily going, was that something bigger than fact. That's one of the ways that Emily described God, or the ultimate aliveness of this world. Something bigger than fact. She spent her life listening for that something, sitting in the forest on her stool, waiting to hear that something. And when she did, she painted it so that all of us could see it too. Now, I could say, go home, turn on your computers and look up these paintings, or open a book and see the pulsing undergrowth and those swirling skies. But instead, why don't you simply look up at the sky? Or walk into the woods or a park near you and stand there and wait until you see and hear or feel that something bigger than fact. May this be so.